This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Jeremiah Jacques, contributing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. I'm filling in today for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. We really appreciate you joining us today on Trumpet Hour, and our panel of trumpet writers have several really big stories that they're anxious to tell you all about. Here in the studio in Edmond, Oklahoma, we have Andrew Miller.
Hello.
And joining us from our office in Jerusalem, we have Brent Noctegal.
Greetings.
Well, this week there was some new satellite imagery published of Syria, and it shows that one of the Middle East's most threatening countries has an even stronger military presence there than experts had believed. To tell us about this, we'll go to Brent Noctegal.
There have been a number of reports that have come out over the past, I would say, 3 months, going back to November, of Iranian built-up bases inside Syria. And just this week, as you mentioned, there was another image that was provided by ImageSat International, obtained by Fox News, and then spread all over the world, which detailed a Iranian base. It's been built up just, I think, 6 kilometers or 6 miles from Damascus, just south of Damascus. So really close to Israel, which is a big concern for the Israelis, of course. Mm-hmm. And it was featured heavily in the newspapers over here because of the proximity. But there is this new base that has been developed over the past few months. The photos show two new white hangars. Each of these hangars are about 30 yards by 20 yards. And inside of them are short to medium range missiles. And this, for Israel, given that it's so close to their territory, is extremely concerning. And it was concerning, obviously, to Fox News as well, to the point that they would put this on their front page for a time. And so they're asking, is this something that the world is willing to come together to try and defeat what Iran's doing? We know that there was people might remember back in November, the BBC was the first to show another Iranian base inside western Syria. And then Israel destroyed that about a month later. And then you had two more Iranian facilities that were destroyed a couple of weeks ago. And here it is. Another one comes out that the Iranians are undeterred. And so they continue to build up bases inside Syria.
So what has the response been so far from Israel and from the U.S.? And what do you think the larger response going forward might be?
Well, the response from Israel has been more of, we know this is going on. We're happy these photos are being made public. And so it's just not coming from Israel saying Iran's doing this, Iran's doing this, Iran's doing this. It's actually international agencies or United States agencies that are doing something. I think Israel is really hoping that somebody else will come to their defense, will come to their aid. The United States right now, they're obviously in Syria. There's 2,000 troops in Syria right now. But as even I believe it was Joseph Votel, he's the head of the U.S. Central Command and what's taking place in Syria, he said, well, right now, while we're watching what Iran's doing in Syria, we're really concerned mainly about the fight against the Islamic State right now. And so Israel's looking at that type of rhetoric and asking, what's it going to take for the United States to get to act? You remember when President Trump came in power and almost immediately fired those Tomahawk missiles from the Mediterranean, blowing up one of Assad's airstrips. Israel was very happy by that because finally some United States leader is willing to take action. But since that time, there's been very little actual action on the ground by the United States against Iran, against Assad. And what we've seen is just increasing evidence that Iran is becoming entrenched in Western Syria, which is extremely dangerous for the Israelis. This isn't Assad's men. This isn't Hezbollah. This is the Iranian Empire. This base itself was built up by the IRGC, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. We know that. And so the Israelis are asking, when is the United States going to act? And if they don't act, will they support us in unilateral action against the Iranians? Israelis see this as something that they have to confront. There's no question in their mind whether they're going to leave these Iranian bases in Western Syria. They have to act on them. And given the fact that press reports come out showing this, then the countdown right now is on before Israel will try and take out this base.
Would you mind taking a little bit of time to just place this in the context of Bible prophecy for us and also to let listeners know where they could go if they'd like to know more information about Iran's presence in Syria and just what's happening with the Middle East?
Yeah, I think it's important to realize that we are seeing something different here. It's easy to say Syrian civil war has gone on for 7 years, almost 7 years now. But what is different? What's different is Iran actually has its own troops, its own forces under its direct command in and around Damascus in Western Syria, posing an extreme threat to Israel. This is what they've always wanted. And as far as Bible prophecy is concerned, it puts Syria at the center of numerous events and in the end time, because we know that from biblical prophecies found in Psalm 83 and also conjunction with Daniel chapter 11, and we have material that can explain those to you in further depth. But the gist of it is we know that Syria is going to eventually choose to not be Iran's lapdog. It's going to choose to, instead of being a base for Iranian or a launching pad for Iranian ambition against Israel, they will choose against that. And right now we don't see that. Right now we see the buildup of Iranian bases inside Syria. And so something's going to have to change there. And we're looking at this wondering whether that change is partially brought on by Israel being willing to confront the Iranians and then maybe somebody coming to help Israel. Bible prophecy, again, does indicate that it would probably be the Europeans that are going to try and put a stop to what Iran's doing in Syria, not even the United States. Something that people could read to guide their understanding of Syria is How the Syrian Crisis Will End. It's by our editor-in-chief. It was written back in 2012, right at the beginning of the Civil War. And it really lays out a plan of what we could see happening really soon in Syria. Iran's not going to give up unless it is told or it is pushed to give up in its ambition inside Syria. And so Israel has the guts to do that, but maybe they don't have the power to do that alone. And so maybe they'll reach out to somebody like Europe to help them in that.
Well, thanks very much for that, Brent. And we'll be sure to have a link to that article in the show notes also for today's episode. Well, we'll go now to another Mediterranean country, the nation of Greece. Greece and its place in the European Union have been back in the news this week. And to tell us about this, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Yes, a lot of people are really optimistic about what's happening in Greece. Anyone who's been watching the news for a good period of time knows that there's been a huge economic crisis there. They've been asking for bailout money from Germany and the European Union. And finally, it looks like this summer that they may have their finances in order enough that they're not going to need more bailouts, maybe. Mm-hmm. But we've got an article up on our Trumpet website right now by our normal Europe correspondent, Richard Palmer, entitled Greece to Remain a European Colony Till 2060. And he really digs into some of the behind-the-scenes figures there that he said that in return for all the bailout money they've received so far, they've been ensnared in many legal deals that says until 70% of Greece's public debt is repaid, which is supposed to happen in 2060, then the country is going to be subject to conditions from the European Union for what they've received already. And he really goes through that they said the European Union pretty much almost has veto power over Greek laws now, that they can't pass any laws that are going to endanger their repayment plan. Otherwise, the deals they've come up with to stabilize their economies are off, which means that, as Richard points out in this article, that the European Commission almost has as much authority over Greece now as the United States government has over the 50 states. Mm-hmm. It's basically a colony of this European empire there that they have to follow the rules set for them by the European Union in order to keep their economy solvent. And this is something we've been pointing to at the Trumpet for many years, even when the European when the euro common currency was first launched, we pointed out that this is kind of the inevitable thing that was going to happen, because just with a little bit of basic economics, you'll see that Germany exports a lot more goods than it imports. Naturally, that should make their currency much stronger than the surrounding European nations. And as their currency gets stronger, it's more expensive for other nations to buy German goods. So the amount they're exporting should go down as stuff gets more expensive. And the system naturally balances itself out that way. When they joined the euro, they basically averaged Germany's strong currency with the weak currencies in Southern Europe, which gave Germany an artificially low or artificially weak currency, which allowed them to just keep exporting and keep exporting and keep exporting until the rest of Europe just owed them massive amounts of debt. And then now Europe's almost beholden. It's a burden on Germany because now they have a lot of debt or a lot of nations that owe them money. Mm-hmm. But these other nations are almost beholden to Germany now, like colonies to the central hub of an empire. And this is not rocket science economics. Anyone involved in the launch of the euro should have been able to see this coming. And there's definitely evidence that a lot of them did see this coming and did it anyway, just so this sort of thing would happen, where Germany has basically conquered Europe without a bullet being shot by making them dependent on them economically. And now they Germany exports exports the goods it manufactures to Southern European countries, and those Southern European countries do what they're told because they're too in debt to be self-sufficient.
In Richard's article there, he says that Italy specifically could be next to sort of fall into this debt trap that we now see Greece in. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, Italy is obviously a much bigger economy than Greece. Mm-hmm. I don't think that Germany could bail out Italy in quite the same way that they can bail out a little nation like Greece. I doubt Italy would ever get to the same standpoint of Greece, where they're basically a colony of the European Empire. They, right. They're definitely more a member state. But Italy does have a lot of the same problems as Greece that will be leading them down the same road, even if they don't get as far down that road. From a prophetic standpoint, we've talked a lot about Revelation 17 and about how there'll be these 10 kings in Europe who give their power over to a central authority referred to as the beast. And given the significance of the Vatican in Italy and the significance of its economy, I think it's pretty safe to say, and we always have said, that Italy at least gets to be one of those 10 kings, even if they will be subservient to Germany and or maybe the European Union. While a nation like Greece, it's less certain whether they're just going to end up as one of those 10 kings or whether they just end up as a colony that does what they're told without a seat at the table.
What literature would you point listeners to if they'd like to know more about those prophecies about the Holy Roman Empire?
Well, we definitely have the Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy by Brad McDonald that we'll put in the show notes. And that's something that takes a big picture overview, tracing the history of the Holy Roman Empire all the way back to when the actual Roman Empire was still around, and the seven resurrections of it. And so that will just give you the big picture of what the Holy Roman Empire is, what its history is, what the Bible prophecy says about its future, as well as some details about how some of these economic measures that they've been using with the euro are bringing this 10-nation union together today.
Well, thanks very much for sharing your insight on that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. And most of the stories that we're discussing today are up on our website, thetrumpet.com, or they will be up there soon if they're not yet. So please visit thetrumpet.com to get more information on these important stories. We're going to take a break in just a moment, but first we'll cover one more story about Vladimir Putin's Russia. The Russian presidential election is just a few weeks away now, and I'm going to take a big risk and go way out on a limb here and say that Vladimir Putin will win another term as Russia's leader. That's actually, of course, not a risky prediction. It's no exaggeration to say that about 99% of analysts and onlookers are convinced that Putin will easily win this election, and that's partly because Russians genuinely support him, and partly because his control over Russia and Russia's military is so tight now that he has the power to stay in office for as long as he would like to, even if he didn't have as much support as he does from the Russian people. But on Wednesday, Putin still did a little bit of campaigning, maybe just to be on the safe side. This was not officially campaigning. It was just the State of the Nation speech that he gives every year. But he still used this opportunity to appeal to his base and to kind of fire up his supporters. This speech was about 2 hours long, and it was attended by hundreds of Russia's top officials and lawmakers. It was also televised across the nation. And parts of this speech are really worth taking a closer look at. What I believe was the most important section of it, he struck a really defiant tone toward the Western world, a tone of defiance that's beyond even what he would normally use for this sort of thing. And he said, quote, "I want to tell those who have fueled the arms race over the last 15 years, sought to win unilateral advantages over Russia, introduced unlawful sanctions aimed to contain our country's development, all that you wanted to impede with your policies has already happened. You have failed to contain Russia." And then he said that Russia has recently tested some very advanced new nuclear weapons, including a nuclear-powered cruise missile and a nuclear-capable underwater drone that he said are basically impossible to intercept. And this was a multimedia presentation, so he was using all these colorful graphics and videos to demonstrate what these weapons are capable of. At one point, he was talking about these hypersonic, supposedly unstoppable missiles, and there was actually a video playing in the background that showed multiple nuclear warheads streaking through space and then showering down on what looked like the outline of the state of Florida. So that's just indescribably provocative, really, to show that sort of thing while you're talking about these weapons. And then right around that point, Vladimir Putin said, quote, "They need to take account of a new reality and understand this is not a bluff." And Putin said that the reason why Russia's been upgrading its nuclear arsenal was because the United States withdrew from the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty back in the year 2002. After that withdrawal, Russia warned the world that it would have to kind of respond by upgrading its own nuclear arsenals. But he said no one wanted to talk to Russia at that time. And then he said, quote, "No one listened to us then, so listen to us now." And at that point, if you watch this video, it's amazing to see just the thunderous applause that broke out in this venue where he was delivering the speech. The people of Russia love this kind of display of strength. They love to see Putin standing up to the United States and to the West. But the truth is that whether America had left that missile treaty or not, Putin has been determined to really make Russia great again since the very beginning of his rule back in 1999. And he even said back in 2005 that the collapse of the Soviet Union was the greatest catastrophe of the 20th century. And he's been working to rebuild the Russian Empire ever since then. We saw that in 2008 when Russia invaded Georgia and it placed some parts of Georgia under Moscow's control. We saw it again in 2014 when Russia annexed Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula. And now Putin's focus on upgrading Russia's nuclear arsenals is, you know, it's really motivated by that same broader goal of just expanding Russia's power, restoring its place on the global stage, and just being able to stand up to the West and make Russia be seen by the world as a nation to be feared. So it's a really important story. And Putin mentioned the U.S. in his address, But Bible prophecy tells us that the real region to watch in terms of how it will respond to Russia's increasing aggression is Europe. Back in 2014, shortly after Russia had annexed Crimea, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury explained the significance of that move for Europe in terms of Bible prophecy. And Mr. Fleury wrote, quote, "We've been prophesying for around 70 years that Eastern Europe would become a vital part of a new European superpower, a resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. This prophecy is directly related to the Crimean crisis. The fear you see in Europe because of events in Crimea is going to cause 10 leaders in Europe to unite in a sudden and dramatic way and in precise accordance with the Bible's description of that European empire. Europe's new fear of Russia is going to play a major role in hastening the fulfillment of that prophecy." End quote. So that's just a really powerful analysis by Mr. Fleury there, just showing that the Europeans are fearful of Russia and how much that plays into what Andrew is talking about with the Holy Roman Empire being unified. The Europeans have not forgotten what happened in Georgia and in Ukraine, and now they see Russia's increasingly belligerent posturing with its nuclear weapons. And the fear of Russia that's now intensifying among many Europeans is making the Europeans want to become more unified politically and militarily, because they know that within a unified European bloc, they stand a far better chance of being able to stand up to this rising Russian threat.
Right. I think especially in Eastern Europe, that's even more prevalent. You'll see, I mean, Finland, the Baltic states, Poland, Ukraine, Bulgaria, even the Czech Republic. These are nations that have been behind the Iron Curtain before, remember what it's like, and are really worried when they see Putin talk about the collapse of the Soviet Union being the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. I know it was back during the earlier times of the Obama administration where he'd nixed a U.S. missile defense shield that they were wanting to put into the area where it was either the president or the prime minister, I think it was the prime minister of the Czech Republic at the time, summarized things fairly poetically when he was talking about how America had abandoned them and they needed to sign this Lisbon Treaty to get into the European Union, because he said it was better to kiss the German chancellor than hug the Russian bear.
Yeah, that's you really do see in these smaller nations that they know that they stand no chance of standing up to Russian aggression on their own. And so there is quite a lot of impetus for the countries in Eastern Europe to throw their support behind Germany. They want Germany to become stronger, and they're willing to put all of their might kind of behind Berlin. But yes, we'll be sure to have a copy of Mr. Fleury's article in the show notes. It's called "The Crimean Crisis is Reshaping Europe." This article goes into quite a lot of detail about prophecies in Ezekiel 38 and Daniel 2 and 8, and also in Revelation. And he just shows that these developments in Russia and Europe are leading to a time of destruction that will cause more suffering than the world has ever known. But Mr. Fleury also shows that ultimately these developments point to very good news. Toward the end of his article, he says, quote, "It does describe a lot of suffering coming upon this world, the worst ever, but it is tied directly to the coming of the Messiah when all suffering ends and God brings peace, happiness, and joy to the world. That is the best news you could ever hear." So any listeners who would like to know more about what Mr. Fleury called the best news you could ever hear there, please read this powerful article that we'll have a link to in our show notes, "The Crimean Crisis is Reshaping Europe." You're listening to Trumpet Hour here on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial, and the live stream is available anywhere in the world if you just type kpcg.fm into your internet browser. Coming up, we're going to talk about the relationship between Iran and Europe. We'll talk about some very worrying news out of South Africa and an attack on Germany by the Russians. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
This is Jeremiah Jacques filling in for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker, and there have been a couple of very interesting developments this week in the complex dynamic between the Islamic Republic of Iran, which plays a major role in end-time Bible prophecies, and Europe, which is an even bigger player in those prophecies. To tell us about this, we'll go once again to Brent.
So people listening to KPCG and Trumpet Radio will be very familiar with the big security conference that took place 2 weekends ago, the Munich Security Conference. And there we had Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu speaking, a number of others speaking. We had also the Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif speaking as well. Well, news came out this week that he almost didn't make it there because of a situation that developed at the Munich airport. He was notified, the Iranian leader, foreign minister was notified a couple weeks before his arrival that the local companies that were going to resupply his private jet with fuel had refused to do so, lest they incur the wrath of the United States, because they were worried that they would break United States sanctions. Hmm. And so they said to Zarif, sorry, we can't refuel your plane. If you want, you can head down and fly into Vienna, just out a little bit further south in Austria, and they might be able to do it, but we're not doing it. And so this actually, even though they presented the Iranian with a number of options, the Munich airport did, the Iranian said, nope, we're coming anyway, and we're going to get Ischinger or whoever, the leader that, or the person that organized the Munich Security Conference, to work it out. And so they did. The German Bundeswehr, military actually refueled the plane of Javad Zarif so that he could make his way on to Moscow for, after that. But I think it's very interesting that we are seeing a real world example of the pressure that the United States is right now pushing on onto European, or putting on European countries in relation to sanctions, in relation to Europe's relationship with Iran.
Yes, we've heard quite a bit recently about United States President Donald Trump threatening to ramp up pressure and even sanctions specifically on Iran, partly over the nuclear deal that was worked out under the Obama administration. Does it look like that deal is under threat at all? And how does that tie into this European-Iranian dynamic?
Yeah, this is, we're coming to crunch time right now. We remember back in January, President Trump said he didn't like the deal. And then he said, I'm going to give the Europeans basically a few months to see if they can fix the deal so we don't have to tear it up. And if we tear up the deal, that means really tight, increased United States sanctions on any company that is doing business with most or many Iranian companies, especially the Iranian government companies, because if you're doing business with an Iranian company that then funds the Iranian government, which they all do, then that money is going straight into the hands of the IRGC. It's going straight into the hands of terrorists across the Middle East. So the United States has given a couple of goals or objectives that the Europeans must coerce the Iranians into giving up if the nuclear deal will continue. They've got to stop their ballistic missile program. They've got to allow for increased inspections of military sites, which right now we're not allowed to do, which is funny, under the deal. And they also asked to delete the sunset clause in the deal, which means after 10 years, Iran can build a bomb. Mm-hmm. And so these are all good points. But the question is, will the Europeans be able to coerce Iran into giving up on these things, to fix the deal, basically? The Europeans, it looks like, want Iran to do that. They want to continue their business investments. A lot of money flooded into Iran. A lot of companies really jumped onto the bandwagon, head down into Iran for all these business opportunities straight off the nuclear deal was signed. And when President Trump's came in, and even before that, he said, hey, that's dangerous. That's dangerous doing that, because when we get in power, we're going to fix this deal or we're going to scrap it. And at that point, if you are heavily invested in Iran, those sanctions are going to affect you, even you in the Munich airport who's supplying fuel to Iranian jets. Hmm. And it looks like the Europeans are taking notice. There's a European delegation heading to Iran next month or this month, and they're going to try and say to the Iranians, hey, we'll do our best to contain Mr. Trump, but you've got to give us something. You've got to stop doing this, that, and the other thing. What we know from the Iranians and what they even said in their news today is that they're not going to budge. And so Mr. Trump's willingness to ramp up sanctions and tear up the deal is putting the European nations who want to continue their financial investments in Iran in a very difficult position.
Could you talk a little bit about how this European-Iranian relationship connects to Bible prophecy and just about what literature you would recommend to listeners who would like to better understand the prophetic significance of it?
Well, I think this is important right now because it is forcing the Europeans to directly negotiate with Iran. And what they're going to find when they do that is something we've been saying for a long, long time at the trumpet, is that they're going to find a belligerent power that will not change. It will not give up on its ambitions. And that is something that Bible prophecy says Europe is going to see extremely close up. They are going to actually change their foreign policy because of Iran's belligerence. And Bible prophecy indicates in Daniel chapter 11 and verse 40 that you've got two powers in the end time, the king of the south, which we have labeled as Iran and radical Islam, and the king of the north, which is Europe led by Germany, where this event took place in Munich. And so they are actually going to clash, and they clash because of what Iran is doing. They clash because of Iran's movements. This isn't an offensive kind of attack on Iran because Iran wasn't doing anything wrong. It says that Iran, this king of the south, is pushing at the king of the north. And maybe through President Trump's desire to scrap this deal, the Europeans are going to see once and for all, maybe, that the Iranians cannot be negotiated with. And maybe they will finally see as well that Europe is also a future target of the Iranian growing empire as well. If people want to read more about this, they can read our trend article. These are articles that basically give the background biblical prophecy. And the one that they could read is Iran and Europe Heading for a Clash of Civilizations.
Europe and Iran on Course for a Clash of Civilizations. We'll be sure to have a link to that very powerful article in the show notes for today's program. Thanks very much for that, Brent. Well, South Africa has just undergone a leadership transition, and there was quite a lot of hope that this shift could bring an end to a lot of the violence and instability that South Africa has been suffering. But news from this week shows that there may not be much cause for all of that optimism after all. To tell us about this, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, it was back in December that the African National Congress put it in its platform that they were going to start taking land from white farmers and redistributing it to other races in South Africa. And that's not necessarily unusual. The ANC has been saying that for some time. But now it actually looks like they're really at least escalating the rhetoric on actually following through with this. The new president in South Africa has gotten up and said that the taking of land from indigenous tribes is South Africa's original sin, and that his government is going to step up and follow through and take this land without compensation and redistribute it. Both the Communist Party and the Economic Freedom Party, Economic Freedom Fighters mm-hmm. Party, which is a Marxist party itself, have said they're going to back this up.
Wow.
And so they passed a resolution through Parliament. And so now really all they're waiting for is a constitutional review panel to get back on the feasibility of if they can do this constitutionally. And it may be somewhat skeptical about whether that constitutional review panel is actually going to let them take the land. But we do have an article up on our website. We'll put in the show notes that I've written entitled South African President Pledges to Take Land from White Farmers that actually makes the case that the type of rhetoric we're seeing could make the violence even worse if they don't take the land. You'll... In Zimbabwe, back starting around the year 2000, the government did step in and take away land from white farmers without compensation.
Right.
It destroyed their agricultural sector, but there was only maybe two dozen deaths. In South Africa, there's already been thousands of farm murders because you have politicians get up and talk about how unfair and how unjust it is that white people own this land, and then they don't take the land away. And so people go go vigilante style and burn people in the night with blowtorches and microwave babies and just other horrible crimes that are they're terrorist acts designed to get farmers to flee their land so that other people can have it.
And has there been much of an exodus of white farmers from South Africa in response to these terrible crimes?
Yes, yes. Actually, the white population in general has been in decline, not only in terms of percentage, but in terms of absolute number for years, which means more people are leaving the country than are being born or moving into it. And so there is Foreign Policy did an article earlier this or late last year entitled "The Last White Africans," indicating that they could just be not be white people in South Africa within the next couple decades.
Wow. Yeah, with that kind of violence happening, you can really see why there would be a lot of impetus to flee. Could you put this in the context of Bible prophecy for us?
Yeah, well, the article definitely goes through some of the history of how these comments are not particularly accurate. The way different peoples migrated into South Africa was quite complicated. But in terms of prophecy, longtime listeners of this program will notice that both the Dutch and the British settlers of South Africa are descended from ancient Israel.
Right.
And there are many prophecies, especially in the book of Ezekiel, also in the book of Isaiah, that talk about if the people of Israel in the end time turn away from God's law, that their cities will burn with fire and the land will be beset by bloody crimes, and the crimes will be almost like a chain, so bloody that they're like links in a chain. One just comes after another with no respite. It even talks about other ethnic groups, non-Israelite ethnic groups. The book of Ezekiel uses the term heathen that would actually come in and possess people's houses. And so that in South Africa is a very, very graphic and realistic description of what is actually happening, where you've got people being murdered and their houses being possessed by the people who killed them. And so this is something that is prophesied to happen not only in South Africa, but similar things in the United States and Britain as well, until people come to the realization that mankind doesn't know how to rule over mankind aside from God's law, and develop the sense of humility to actually be willing to look into the Bible and look into the way of God and the way that will produce peace and solve racial problems. And it's really a shame and a testament to how hard human nature is that it does take so much to get people to pay attention to God's law. But as you mentioned earlier, soon enough, people will learn that lesson, and Jesus Christ will be able to come back and start giving people instruction as soon as they're ready to listen.
Yes, so this is really a preview of what's to come for the U.S. and the U.K. and other nations, which is very sobering, but there's also a lot of hope tied to this message. Well, as Andrew said there, we have an article up on thetrumpet.com right now that he wrote about this. It's called "South African President Pledges to Take Land from White Farmers." So please go to thetrumpet.com and check that out. And we'll be sure to have a link to that in our show notes for today's program. Thanks very much for that, Andrew. All of the stories that we're discussing today, or just about all of them anyway, are published on thetrumpet.com. So please be sure to visit there and check these stories out. And also please subscribe to our free print edition and our free email news briefs. For our next story, we'll talk about an attack that the German government suffered this week at the hands of Russian hackers. And to talk about this, we'll stick with Andrew Miller.
Yeah, I guess shifting to a very different part of the globe up in Germany, there's a very highly sophisticated software system implanted in the German government's data network that hacked the system, is targeted for specific bits of information, sensitive information that they haven't necessarily released what the hackers learned for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
But it was on like parliament or German government servers. And so quite the feat. And the government hasn't come out and assigned blame yet, but almost all German media sources have accused the Russians of perpetrating this hack. They'd be one of the nations that definitely would have had the capacity to do it. They're still looking for the specific group. There's a famous Russian hacker group known as Snake. Another one called APT-28. Not as catchy of a name there.
I heard that Fancy Bear is also possibly guilty of this.
Fancy Bear is pretty famous because Fancy Bear was actually accused of hacking German parliaments 2 years ago and are one of the groups they think may have hacked the Democratic National Committee here in the United States with the whole WikiLeaks thing. So the Fancy Bear definitely gets around with its hacking. And so this is something that Germany's pretty worried about. They're having elections coming up possibly later this year if they can't get coalition governments together, mm-hmm. And then regional elections. And then especially with the allegations that the hack of the DNC may have exposed information that could have influenced American voters, they're concerned something like that could happen in Germany.
Yes.
And so they do have rules in Germany that the country's military is legally allowed to initiate cyber combat to protect government sources, not necessarily against private sources right now. But that does really get to the some of the two main cruxes of what this is prophetically is. The first part is kind of a similar story to what you were mentioning earlier about the nuclear weapons, where there's this fear of Russian nuclear weapons is driving Europe into a superpower.
Right.
Also, this fear of Russian hackers who can hack your parliament and hack your government mainframes is leading that same trend where nations like Germany are realizing that they do need more cyber capacity and they do need to be more powerful on the world scene to defend themselves against this. And the second thing is tying into that point about Germany's military being allowed to initiate a cyber offensive against something like this is they've just recently, we recently had a feature in the Trumpet about like almost an entire division of Germany's military being trained for cyber offensives because they're realizing that this is kind of like the war of the future and this is something they're vulnerable to attack to. And this is something that they not only need to be able to defend themselves against, it's something that they need the capacity to do themselves, to attack nations using cyber warfare. Editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury's classic articles that we just seem we come back to again and again is called America's Achilles Heel and Germany. And he'd written in there that he said, I believe one key end time Bible prophecy could well be fulfilled through this kind of cyber terrorism. Mr. DeCourcy describes, they have blown the trumpet even to make all ready, but none goes to battle, for my wrath is upon the multitude thereof. That's in Ezekiel 7:14. He says, the trumpet of war is to be blown in Israel, mainly America and Britain. It seems everyone is expecting our people to go to battle, but the greatest tragedy imaginable occurs. No one goes to battle, even though the trumpet is blown. Will it be because of computer terrorism? And so now we're seeing today, I mean, Russia doing hacks on Germany developing segments of their military to fight cyber wars to defend themselves against Russia. And this prophecy that at some point there's going to be a German led European superpower that attacks America. The trumpet of battle sound, but America doesn't respond. And Mr. Fleury is definitely, definitely thinks, and he makes a very good case in this article we'll put in the show notes, that one of those reasons is that they just have developed cyber capacity where they were able to take out America's communication systems, and the trumpet's blown and no one hears it.
It's very sobering. Well, thanks very much for that, Andrew. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. You can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Please visit us there to read more about the stories that we're discussing today and to subscribe to our print edition and our free news brief, which we send out several times each week. Tell us what you think of the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks very much to our panel today, Andrew Miller and Brent Noctegal. Thanks also to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Jesse Hester, and we'll leave you today with some words from Haile Selassie. Throughout history, it has been the inaction of those who could have acted, the indifference of those who should have known better, the silence of the voice of justice when it mattered most, that has made it possible for evil to triumph. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.